Forge the Narrative.
Hey everybody, welcome to Forge the Narrative. We are the Bell of Lost Souls podcast. My name is Paul Murphy, your host. I'm joined tonight by Chris Morgan.
What's up, guys?
And Reese Robbins.
Hey, hey.
What's going on, guys?
Just doing the do.
It has been 0 days since last incident on Vigilus.
Getting excited.
What do we call it? We don't want to call it V-Day. Vigilus Day. Or it's Abaddon Day.
This is one day after we've got the model spoiled for, or leaked, or previewed for Abaddon. And then it's out of control. I love it how it mimics and mirrors Guilliman.
It's so good. It's such a good model. He's better than Guilliman by a mile, in my opinion.
Well, because you're a heretic.
Sure.
to be fair, most planks of wood are more interesting than Guilliman.
Come on, man. He's got a flaming sword. It's awesome. It is an, Guilliman is an epic model.
Yeah, but it's not even his sword, man.
It is now. Dad's asleep. He took the keys to the car, baby.
Nobody's seen him. That's right. He's got the talking stick.
What I'm saying is, it's the reason the Emperor calls him like 13 or something.
But imagine, I mean, think of the artistry involved in the design. I mean, this is a clear, like if you were looking at this as a Renaissance painting, it would be an absolute clear depiction of this Abaddon is the enemy of all that is good and holy in the universe.
I was immediately not a fan as soon as I saw the helmet that was on top of his trophy rack.
Oh, is it a Blood Angels? Please tell me it is.
I'll let you see for yourself. I don't even want to talk about it anymore. Well, I shouldn't have brought it up.
I mean, I get it. We're all going to have our bias one way or another towards this model, but I mean, mirror image or reflection of Guilliman, who is, you know, the poster boy of the Imperium. He's the size. Think about the model size of the Abaddon figure that we've had. It's from second edition. That thing is, you know, a hobbit compared to Primaris Marines and stuff that we have now. And here we have the next version of this guy is Primarch size. Now, look, we don't have his stats. I'm not going to talk about his stats. But that's just visually, that's a clear like message just with the size and the mirror image and everything else. I think it's awesome.
Well, it lines so much more up with how he's described in pretty much every single written word, where he's supposedly a Horus clone, or at least people can think of him like that. You know, he should be bigger. He should be more intimidating. The old model, you know, all due respect to the old model when it came out, I'm sure everyone was just as crazy about it as we are for this one.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an amazing model. It's still an amazing model.
Well, the second edition model was the coolest model in the game for a really long time, because you got to remember, a Terminator was on a 25 millimeter base. You know what I mean?
Oh, like, I've still got him.
Yep. Me too. I do too. And so, like, he was huge at the time, and he looked amazing. But the game keeps scaling up because the technology allows for it. And now he's what he always should have been, right? Like, he's a dominating figure on the tabletop. And you look at an army and you instantaneously know who's the boss.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, all joking and bitterness aside, I am very much looking forward to fighting against Abaddon on the tabletop. I was joking in my local group that if I ever killed him in close combat, that the model that did so, I would buy an Abaddon and just put the Talon of Horus on the base just as a deal with it, you know, just something to kind of commemorate what was going on. I think it's a great model. I can't wait to see what people do with it.
Well, I think it's great that the lore is unfolded to where he is I mean, I think it was a little bit of a stretch to recognize him as the absolute champion of chaos, but that also has, like, my personal bias injected into that. I think the stories have been great that have led him to that point. And now we've got this amazing model. Then we've got all this artistry that goes into the depiction of the model. I'm really happy that it exists, and I can't wait to see more about it.
Yeah, and they gave him his big win, too, right, with Cadia, to lead up to the release of the new model. So he doesn't feel like Phaladon anymore. Like, he feels like he gave a giant black eye to the Imperium and his plan is working. And I think that was the right call, right? Like, he doesn't feel like a joke.
Abaddon,
like,
he's like, 14th times the charm.
Right, yeah,
to see how many times it takes him to take Vigilus.
I bet it's not going to be 14.
Yeah.
Yeah, it'll probably be like 13 or 12.
He's like, baby steps, man.
Look, it's a 10,000-year-old war or whatever? Come on. He's got it. He's doing it. But anyway, I just wanted to gush about the model a little bit
and
joke about the, you know, the countdown, the days till we got it released or whatever, than the incident calendar for Virtualis. I'm excited. Well, Reese, I got you on to talk about big ITC changes that are coming up this season. Now,
yeah.
we did a lot of coverage for the road to the LVO. I went to the LVO this year, had an amazing time. It's on my list of must-dos. It should be on everyone's list of must-dos.
I would hope so.
But now here we are in a brand new season for ITC scoring, and there's some changes coming up. So I thought, you know, who better to talk about it than the man himself?
Well, thank you so much. Yeah, it's this year was... It was a big year in so many different ways, and we're really feeling the difference, right? More than any other year. We had over 12,000 people in the ITC between AOS and 40K. And just 5 years ago, we had 450 people total. So the growth has been ridiculous, and it really hit a different gear this year. And so it required us to make a lot of changes coming into the new season, more than normal. And not so much with just like the specifics of missions and stuff, but more like structural changes to reflect just how big it's gotten.
Do you mind elaborating on that a little bit?
Yeah. So one of the main changes that we made was the change to the scoring formula. And if you're someone who's enthused about the ITC and you track your points and all that fun stuff, go check Best Coast Pairings or go check the scores on Frontline Gaming under the ITC tab, because the new formula has been implemented. And we've gone back and retroactively updated the scores, and you'll notice it's quite a bit different. Well, and we did that because people were more noticing or feeling or expressing that big events just kind of dominated the season. Specifically, the LVO is worth, you know, it was worth more points than the majority of people got in the entire year.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. Like, the ITC is another level of competition. So if you run tournaments or go to tournaments that do ITC scoring, you gain points not just for the tournament that you're playing in, but then you gain points that compete against everyone in the world for either your faction or overall placement or whatever in this independent tournament circuit.
Exactly, right? Thank you for defining it. I just assume sometimes that people know what we're talking about, but they don't always. And it's been a lot of fun, and people get really enthusiastic about it. And it breaks down into regional. You can track points via your region, via your faction, your overall global ranking, your team ranking. And people have gotten really excited about it. It's super duper fun. And we have a competitive track and a hobby track. So even if you don't really give a hoot about winning or losing games, but you really love painting models, you can be the best Tau hobbyist in the South region of the United States of America.
See, that's really fun. I mean, because we debuted that and talked about this on this show. I mean, and to see it actually become something that people get to win awards for worldwide is pretty exciting.
It really is. And this year, the 40K hobby track went bananas. Guys and gals were getting super, super into it. And the armies that came to the LVO to compete to win it were absolutely stunning. And a shout out to Lou Rollins, who won it all. His display board was like, it was ridiculous. It was like 12 cubic feet or something. Like, it was like three or 4 feet tall, 2 feet wide, 2 feet deep. And it was like a diorama of his whole army and a waterfall coming. It was unreal.
I saw that. It was absolutely stunning.
Yeah. And to see people go to that level with it is so cool.
Well, I remember the first time I played in the LVO something like 4 years ago. The progress that the hobby has made so far as showing at LVO there's no comparison. There were games where I played against people that had pretty much unpainted models, you know, when I went to LVO the first time. And now we have people who are bringing big displays. It's like, it's creeping up a little bit towards kind of the showmanship that you would expect from events like, you know, the Adepticon singles and things like that, because people like to bring their best stuff to Adepticon.
Well, you're showing out. I mean, it's part of the stuff is, I mean, you know, we talk about paying for points all the time, but you're also kind of flexing in front of your peers, you know, showing out. You want people to walk by and go, oh man, that's nice.
Yeah, totally. And that was one of the reasons why we increased the standard of modeling and hobby at the LVO. And every year we just keep bumping it up. And it's because it got really, really loosey goosey and bad, to be blunt. And I was guilty of it myself, like going to events that had no painting standard, you know, people showing up with toys, with proxies, with gray armies, and it really kind of ruins your immersion in it. And if, especially the LVO is supposed to be the world championships of the ITC season. And it is, when you show up, you expect to see the best. You want the best competition, the best sportsmanship, the best appearance. And it wasn't reflective of that. So I'm glad people are noticing it. because we literally will pull your models off the table if they're not the appropriate standard. And it's not like we like doing that, but it's you want that total immersion. You want to spend the money, take the time, go and just get and have your socks blown off.
Yeah, sorry to sidetrack us, you know, but part of that is you want people to walk around and see exemplary, you know, things in the hobby, and so they go and tell their friends about it, and then those people get inspired to do some stuff to come to the next one that you do. But yeah, I know I sidetracked us a little bit. We're talking about point changes and stuff for the ITC.
Oh yeah, no, not a problem. I mean, that's all part of it, right? So not a problem at all. And so within the context of the ITC, you get points for going to events. The bigger the event, the more rounds of play, the more points you get, because the more rounds represent how hard it is to win, because there's more chances to lose a game. And the bigger the event represents, the more prestigious and cool, and also greater degree of difficulty, because there's a bigger pool of talent. And so we wrote the formula initially years ago. And when we first wrote the formula, it's relatively simple. It's based off the World Series of Poker. It worked really well at the time. But at the time, the biggest events in the world were 256 players, and there was only three of them, right? And in the last, especially since 8th edition has come out, like the tournament scene has been steadily growing since 5th edition. But especially when 8th came out, it's like the gas pedal got pushed all the way down and events are exploding all around the world. There's more of them and they're growing rapidly, especially the LVO. And so the formula that we built was it. The formula that we wrote was written assuming a kind of a level playing field, and the playing field became unlevel and the math got really skewed to the point where some of the bigger events just kind of like dominated the landscape.
And because it was just a math equation. It wasn't exactly bias. It was when you have this number of rounds, this many players, and that equates to this ratio of points or whatever they get awarded for placement.
Exactly. And there was no ill intent. Like people are like, oh, you guys did this on purpose. And I was like, I wish I was that smart. I wish 5 years ago I would have seen where this was going to go. And I was like, no, we wrote it. It was fair when we wrote it, and then it became unfair over time. Unintentionally. And so people were expressing, you know.
Well, how do you sit there and plan? I mean, just to play a little bit of devil's advocate, like how do you sit there in your store and say, like, one day 800 people are going to be here?
Yeah, exactly. Like we thought when we first started the LVO, I remember we had like a pep talk because it was really scary and we were risking our business. And I was like, guys, one day we could have like 400 people. Everyone was like, you're crazy. Like, I was like, no, man, think about it. It's possible. We could do it. And we thought 512 was like, you know, shooting the moon. And then we did it. And it was like, oh, wow. Holy crap. This is a paradigm shift. Like, it's a landscape we never even envisioned. We never even imagined it. We never even joked about a 1,000-person tournament. Like, it was so outlandish, it seemed ludicrous. And I think that we're actually going to do it in the next 2 years. You know, and it's crazy.
Yeah, man.
But it's also so cool.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's absolutely awesome.
It's so cool. Like, this has gone so far beyond anything we had ever imagined. And the ITC has been a big part of it. And just, you know, the professionalism of events has increased. People take it more seriously, in a good way, right? Like they care more about doing it correctly. Pushback on it was, I don't feel as motivated to go to events because I feel like if I don't go to LVO, I don't have no chance in hell of doing anything.
Well, that's what came about after this last one. People were like, oh my goodness, I was like best in my faction. And then one guy showed up and did mediocre at the LVO. And so, and then he just crushed me or whatever.
Yeah.
You know? Now, look, I'm only presenting the other side of it. I think that was just the nature of the beast because of the magnitude of it and how the math worked. That wasn't, and it was completely transparent at the time, but now we can do a little bit of a post-mortem and say, how do we do it better?
Exactly, right? And I'm not going to lie, at first I was really resistant to the idea because the LVO, like I tell people all the time, I was like, I could buy a very nice house anywhere except California for what it costs to run the LVO. And having that unintentional benefit of making it almost mandatory was a really nice financial safety net for us. Because I was like, oh, pretty confident that we could push forward because a lot of people are going to feel like they have to go. Again, we did not do that on purpose. It was kind of an unintended consequence that was beneficial for us.
Yeah, and we are talking about, like, you know, fake points, you know, sweet chips. or whatever. I mean, for people right. that are competing in something that throughout the whole year, I mean, right, that only matters to them or could potentially only matter to them for perspective. That's why I'm mentioning that.
Right. And whether or not it's an actual anything that's relevant, it's a perceived advantage from our perspective. And I'm just being like totally bluntly
yeah,
honest.
Yeah, yeah, I'm with you.
So people were like, oh, you need to change the scoring formula. And at first I was like, yeah, right. Like, I was like, everybody else, make your event bigger. And then people started coming to me like TOs. And they're like, there's literally no venue in my state that can fit that many people. And I'm like, all right, well, that's pretty legitimate. Or in the UK, they're like, there's like two venues in the country.
You can rent the Olympic Stadium.
Right. So then I started to try and be a little bit more realistic about it. And I was like, all right, this is not fair. Right. And the ITC is supposed to be all about growing community, being fair, being transparent.
Well, encouraging participation.
Exactly. And the whole system was set up to empower TOs to run events in the bad old days of 6th and 7th. Like, we started it before that, but it really took off in 6th and 7th edition when the game was like almost unplayable out of the box. And that was when GW was not writing FAQs. So there was like all these crazy rules problems, and I won't go down that rabbit hole all the way, but it created an environment that needed someone, a third party, to come in, and we just happened to be there at the right time. And so, you know, kind of from that soup, that's where we really took off. And it was all about being fair, right? And so it kind of made me take a step back, and I was like, all right, you know, everyone's making a good point. My mind has been changed. Let's reevaluate this to level the playing field to a reasonable degree. If you don't go to the big events, you should not win. And if we created a system in which that happened, we would have been, that's participation awards should not get you the top, yep. top spot.
Yeah.
I don't, you know, that's a bridge too far, but it should be more fair, right? And if you're a new event organizer and you want to run a 5-person event in a rural area, you should feel like that's a meaningful contribution and it's a good starting point, because our crew started out running 8-person events, and now we run an 800-person tournament. And that was the humble beginning, you know, and anywhere that would let us run a tournament, right? Like, so it should be inclusive, and you should feel like you have a meaningful contribution. And then that's why, long story short, that's why we changed the formula. And with people who are way smarter than me, we spent quite a bit of time working on it. Honestly, I didn't even understand the math at first. I had to go.
Can you explain it right now?
All right. In broad strokes, it's no longer a linear progression. It's algorithmic.
Yep.
And it works so much better on the scale that we're talking about. It's a really complex formula, and I can't take credit for it. I gave feedback on it.
But it still has the root of how well you do at any given event, right?
Yes. So I'm probably not explaining it very well. I'll try and simplify it. The old system was a linear progression. The bigger the event, the more points you got. And then you got a multiplier based on the number of rounds. Every round you won until your first loss, you got bonus points. And that's basically how it worked. And then the progression, the scale down from first place to last place. Basically, if you weren't in the top 8, your score just tanked. And a lot of people were like, oh, I got 10th place at a 50-person event, but a guy that got third place at an RTT with 12 people got more points than me. That doesn't seem fair. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. That isn't fair. So it's now a curve, and the math of it varies based on how big the event is and how many rounds of play. But now the way we've altered it too is you get points for every win. It doesn't matter if you lose your first game and then you win all 4 of your next games. In the old system, you would have got 0 bonus points. So now you'll get a bonus point for every win and points for a tie, but your multiplier varies based on when you lose. So if you go 4-1 and lose your last game, you get significantly more points than if you go 4-1 but lose your first game. The difference now is if you go 4-1 and lose your first game, you still get bonus points.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm tracking.
So and then the big modifier is now the number of players doesn't matter as much. The number of rounds is more meaningful. So an event like the LGT, which had 430 players, it's a behemoth, but it was only 5 rounds. That's not as difficult to win as it is to go to like an Adepticon. And I'm not talking about missions. I'm not talking about quality of players or any of this stuff. But at Adepticon, even though there's only 256 players, there's 8 rounds of play. So in order to win, you have to win 8 games. Winning 8 games is harder than winning 5 games. So the way that the new system breaks down is that an event like an Adepticon will count for roughly the same amount of points as an event like LGT. Even though it's a bigger event, the fact that there's less failure points means it ends up getting weighted relatively similarly. Now, if the LGT was to go to 6 or 7 rounds, it would be worth significantly more, as it should. But that in a nutshell is kind of the way the new system works, and I think people are going to be really happy with it.
You think this because it will somehow level out what the point progression people could go to a series of medium-sized events or just whatever events are available to them, and they can still have a chance of competing for top spots?
Yeah, totally, right? So the gap between the rich and the poor has been shrunk significantly. So let's say you go to a 16-person or an 8-person RTT now, right? If you win, you're going to get roughly 150 points. In the past, you would have gotten like 116 points. If you win the LVO, now it's going to be just a bit over, well, last year, it would have been ended up being just about, or this year, I should say, just about, it would have been over 300 points. I'm sorry, it would have been significantly more than that. Now it's going to be about 300 points. So the difference between the LVO, which is the biggest event, and an RTT, an 8-man RTT, which is about as small as they get, it's a 2-to-1 ratio as opposed to before where it was like 4-to-1. The LVO was worth like so many points that it erased basically all the RTTs you got throughout the course of the year.
Yeah, it's interesting.
And again, because the way the points scale, it'll make more sense to people, because people are going to still think about it in a linear manner. It's like, oh, if I go to 4 RTTs, it's the same as going to the LVO. It's not at all. If you don't go to the big events and perform well, you will not win overall, and you're probably not going to win best in faction if you don't go to at least a couple big events, but that's exactly the way it should be.
Yeah, that's exactly what it should be like. If you are playing against, and arguably at the bigger tournaments, there are a higher percentage of the more competitive, tougher players to line up against as well. To have someone who wins, you know, 8 or 9 games against some of the hardest players out there to lose to somebody who's, you know, maybe a big fish in a small pond, that kind of takes the wind out of your sails, you know?
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense, right? Even though that's the big fish in the small pond, and I used to be that guy, 100%. I was that guy until I moved to a big city and
came to Adepticon and got wrecked by Mephiston.
Yeah, exactly, until Paul Murphy ruined my dreams. That person,
your nemesis.
Paul Murphy is my Everest one day. But like that, to that person, whether it's ego driven or whether it's just a matter of the fishbowl perspective, they really do feel like, hey, I always win. Like I by the measuring stick that's relevant to my life, I'm really good, but I got, you know, 9,000 in the ITC or whatever. You do want to give a tip of the hat to that person, even though their perception is perhaps not broad enough to really understand the bigger picture. You don't want to ostracize that person at the same time.
But the award categories this year are going to be the same. So there's still going to be best in faction, best overall in the ITC. I mean, that's all staying the same, right?
Indeed.
It's just how you generate points is different.
Right, right. So going to smaller events is going to be more meaningful. GTs, which are the bread and butter, that's the majority of event. Oh,
and these are under 58 person events. Between 28 and 58 or something. Is that what the?
Yep. Okay. Yep. So the GT is kind of like, that's the, like the meat and potatoes of what constitutes most people's scores. The GT is going to count for way, way more than it did. Right. And if you got the example I use on the podcast today is that, I just went 2-2-1 at a GT last weekend. Like I literally was dead smack in the middle. My score in the old system to the new system, it basically doubled. And that's going to be the most meaningful difference to the majority of people, right?
So the people that actually are getting out to tournaments, they don't have the fear of their score being erased by one of these mega tournaments that exist.
Exactly, right? So we took the data from last year and we ran it through the new system. The top 10 stayed. I think there was only one person that dropped out and was replaced. And there was a little bit of shifting where one person went down a slot and one person went up a slot. But essentially the top 10 remained the same. But like Brandon Grant, for example, who won he got 946 points. The next person was 892. His win was like 7 points instead of like 56 points, whatever that turns out to be. Even though it's a very significant difference because the math is different, it feels like it's more, it's a lot less of a gigantic gap from, you know, first to second to third to fourth. Like the spread between the top 5 was like 20 points. It was much closer.
Man, that's cool. I mean, I don't think that there was any shortage of, I mean, you mentioned 12,000 people or whatever that are competing out there, but not everyone's competing for the sometimes they just happen to be incidentally going to an ITC tournament.
Yeah, the vast majority of people are competing for best in faction. That's the thing that matters to them.
Yeah, but I mean, it seems like this is going to be better for everyone to score points. I
don't know,
I'm liking what you're saying.
100%. And at the regional level too, like if you want to be the best orc player in the South, it matters even more because you don't have as many events to go to. So the majority of options that are available to you are RTTs and GTs. Those count for way more now. So your odds of achieving your goal are dramatically higher if you're willing to put in the effort.
I'm digging it. Any other big changes we should know about?
Oh, there's a ton. I don't want to overwhelm you, but that's just on the scoring formula. there was a lot of changes. We did a lot of polling, asking for feedback on the missions. And missions are obviously a big deal because that's what determines how you achieve your objective of winning a game.
Outside of just the tabulation of points and being able to track performance and how you rank up against other people around the world, you guys also have a series of missions that people can just download and that a lot of people have exposure to. So it's kind of easy to insert into an event if you are not creating your own missions or want something, if you're starting something locally, maybe trying to build something that people might be familiar with, because I think familiarity is key to success in tournaments or whatever, but you guys have a mission pack.
Yeah, indeed. And the first rule of the ITC is always that every part of the ITC is optional. We're not trying to force anything on anybody. People often lose sight of that, but we're not a dictatorship. We provide guidelines and a starting point. That said, the mission pack that we have is based on literally 10,000 plus people playing them, feedback, trial and error. We have a ITC TO Facebook group, which if you are a TO interested in or currently running events, reach out to me. We'll add you to the group.
And that's this is any size event. This is like you're running.
You could run a 4-person. Yeah, totally. Everybody's voice matters. And that's where we make a lot of these decisions. So if that's you, please reach out and we'll get you in there. But tons of people had all this great feedback. And in that kind of brew is where we came up with some of the new ideas for the missions to improve them based on player feedback. So one of the number one points of feedback in the old mission pack was it's really hard to score points against Eldar. And, no offense to the Eldar players, but we basically made a mission that would be really good to pick against Eldar, and that's called Pick Your Poison.
So
and
all offense to Eldar players.
Well, Eldar is my second favorite army to play, right? So that applies to me too. But the reason why Eldar armies are hard to pick secondaries for in our mission set is because they're such an efficient and good army that they don't need to max out on things. Like they'll take like 3 vehicles instead of 4. So it's like, it's difficult to get Big Game Hunter a mission in which you get points for taking out big units. They'll take 2 psykers, maybe 3 HQs total. So Headhunter, the anti-HQ mission won't really apply. So and they just slip right under the threshold on all these different categories. So we made a mission where it's like, okay, you pick 1 from every category, and then if you get those, you max out your points. So that one's been really well received. One of the other points of feedback was there's units that are really, really durable, really powerful. They're very impactful on the game. But if I take out that unit, which takes a massive amount of resources, I get 1 point. Things like Bulgrin, Veritas Praetors, Grotesques, any number of units that are like this, like a big unit of Deathwing Knights now are starting to get prevalence in that role. I know it's funny.
That. Don't say that.
You laugh, but we had some people who did extremely well at the ITC with missions like this. The LBO. Units.
I hear you. Yeah.
So it's a bully unit. It's kind of like the nomenclature that people are using now. It's the big unit. You throw some buffs on, you push them right in your opponent's face, and you like deal with it. And often they can't. So we came up with a mission Gangbusters, which is aimed at units like that. So you get points for taking out chunks of the unit at a time. And that one's been well received. And all of these are in beta too, just FYI. So they could change by the end of March. And then
these are secondary. So the primary things with the missions is you score a point. You can score points for holding an objective or killing a unit. You score points for killing more or holding more. And then there's a series of secondary objectives that you pick yourself out of a list of 10, 12 different things or whatever that you think you can achieve against your opponent. So that's the dynamic of the missions.
Exactly. The primary mission is the core concepts of the game. Stand somewhere, kill something. It's funny when I've been saying it for years, but because I've been writing missions for years. And when you think about it in a game like 40K, that is literally the only things you can do to win the game is that or inverting it somehow. Like don't let somebody stand somewhere. Or you don't stand somewhere, don't let somebody kill something, or don't kill something in your opponent's army. But those core concepts, that's literally the only things you can do to win a mission. Mm-hmm. And that's why we wrote him this way. It's like, what are the most fundamental aspects of the game? Stand somewhere, kill something. And we're like, well, let's just make that the primary. And it continues to be very popular on all of the feedback that we get. The primary is the most enjoyed portion of the missions. So that part's fun. And then the secondary is there to allow you to take a look at what your opponent's got, look at the terrain, look at the mission, and determine what you think, looking at your opponent's list, you can maximize your chances of getting those potentially 12 bonus points for per mission. And that part is purely player skill. Like, our goal is to give you a mission that you could get 4 points, 4 out of 4 for every one of those missions in any scenario. It's up to you to pick the right ones, right? And that's where the player skill comes in. And we felt like we were lacking, so we added some in based on player feedback to fill those gaps. And the other two were board control missions, King of the Hill, Hold the Center, Engineers, where you nominate 2 units. And over the course of the game, they can stand on an objective, do nothing else, earn you a point. And credit where it's due, we did get that from Nova. They had it at their last event. It was a lot of fun. And then that's where we're at with the missions. And we're also throwing in chapter approved style deployment on half of the missions. And that's like old school deployment, where if you're going first, you deploy your whole army, your opponent deploys, tries to seize, and then you go about your business. And we're still debating pretty hotly how we're going to go with that. It was basically 50-50 which kind of deployment people wanted to go with. So we said, let's do both until the end of March, and then we can all vote on it and see which one we want to do. Or keep it 50-50.
Yeah, sounds good. But at the same time, people could choose to change that if they were to even use your missions and the core concepts. They could do whatever they want for deployment, and they could still contribute to points for ITC. It's all modular.
Yeah, and you could play ETC missions. You could play Adepticon missions. You could play book missions. We really don't care what missions you're playing. Just the only thing that we ask is advertise it in advance, because if you're being advertised as an ITC event, people are going to come expecting the pack. So just make sure it's very clear to your opponents, like, hey, we're going to mix it up. We're going to do something fun. Or, hey, I hate the ITC missions. I think they're stupid. And I want to, we don't, like, whatever, sure. Like, we don't care at all. Like, not in the slightest. And do what's going to make your people happy, right? That's the game's about having fun. So just make sure that you make that very clear, so that there's no unfortunate misconceptions that people drive.
Even if your area wants to play a certain thing, they want to play straight out of the book, like big rule book missions, you can still do that and still contribute to the ITC points.
100%.
I think the biggest thing that determines what you're going to bring so far as your list is concerned is how are you going to accomplish the objectives? If you don't know what the objectives are, if you don't know what the missions are.
Yeah, no. I believe you should always, if you want people to come to your tournament, you are obliged to publish what your missions are well in advance. So people, I mean, it's a huge thing for people's enjoyment of the game, knowing what to expect, enjoy the day to know what to expect.
Yeah, and that's what I was saying. What I think it's funny, and again, everyone's free to run their event how they choose, right? But when people don't show their missions in advance, I'm always like, why? Like, why? Like, why don't you just publish them in advance so people can prepare? They're taking a vacation to come, especially like a GT or a major.
Oh, you've so got it. If it's a 2-day event, you have to. Yeah. Come on. You have to.
It's at least one night in a hotel or crashing on someone's couch. And, you know, it's like people are spending a lot of money. It's like they want to come and be prepared. I never understood the logic of hiding the missions. It's totally lost on me. It's like, I want to come to this event as prepared as possible. I can't do that if I don't know what the game that we're playing is. It's like coming to a football game and they're like, maybe a touchdown's worth 5 points or 6 points. Maybe it's worth 1 point, you know? And you're like, okay, like, that's pretty important to my game plan.
I don't know.
A first down is 15 yards this game. You're like, oh, good.
I don't know who needs that info, but we gave it to them. So there we go.
Let's just take a moment and just be grateful we don't have the tactical objectives anymore like we used to. The random card deck.
No, you say that, but I get emails and messages at least 3-4 times a week.
No, thank you.
From European players, UK players that are like, why don't you guys just use the Maelstrom deck? It's the best. It's so tactical. And I'm like, okay.
I don't know about, I mean, maybe it is. Maybe tactical in the truest definition of the word. I don't know. Maybe it is. But
it's gotten better. It's less random than it was. To be fair, it has definitely gotten better, but it is still so random. And but,
people may enjoy playing that way. And that's fine too. I mean, what I'm telling you is if that's what you need to get people out to your store in the middle of wherever you are and get 8 to 10 people there, then that's the missions you run, man. Just do that.
Yeah, 100. I tell people that every single day. I'm like, you do what is going to be best for your local community. If that means everybody puts a pizza on their head and has to sing their favorite song on karaoke in the breaks.
Listening. Wait a second. I'm listening.
Yeah. And if that is what makes people happy and puts butts in seats and gets people energized to play the game, then that is what you do.
Let's take a quick break. We'll come back and continue this conversation. And we might even slip in some GC Lookout stuff.
Nice.
See you in a minute.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
Hey everybody, we are back. In this episode, I'm actually going to record a vendor segment. I don't know if it's going to be part of this show or the next one. I also have got David Annandale lined up for later on, either coming up the next couple of weeks or hopefully soon to talk about the Warhammer horror stuff that's coming out.
Sounds like a fun chat.
Well, I don't know if you, Chris, you don't know if you remember. You know, we've been doing this for 6 years, almost 6 years at this point.
Yep.
So it's a long time. And it was about a year ago where we had Mr. Annandale on and we talked about the Warhammer horror stuff. So to see that stuff finally coming out and to get to talk to the doctor of horror himself is going to be exciting.
Yeah, I think he's the perfect guy to talk to about that kind of thing, too. If you follow him on Twitter, there's always, I think every day there's like a new old like poster or movie or something you would never even have heard of, you know, like the kind of thing you expect to like the joke posters about this man has been attacked by 50 crabs on the beach and there's a screaming woman in the background, all the way over to like the thing that came from somewhere, you know, it's like it's all super retro, super legit. He knows his stuff. And it's very fun to talk to him. We've interviewed him, I think, twice.
Yeah, I don't know if he likes me to refer to him as that, but he does have an advanced degree in horror. So,
yeah, he teaches classes in university.
Where do you get that degree?
It's somewhere prestigious. I mean, the dude knows his stuff. I mean, that's it.
Well, you know what? To be fair, I when I went to university, we had a gentleman whose specialty was cyberpunk.
Nice. Okay.
And that was actually one of the coolest classes I took in university.
I bet, man. I remember, cyberpunk. I mean, the Neuromancer.
Oh, dude.
Stuff first came out.
William Gibson is still his late. Have you read his newest book?
I have not read the newest, but what's the newest book?
Peripheral is the book, and it is exceptional. Like, Neuromancer is the best. It's the top of the mountain for William Gibson. I've read every single one of his books, but if you're a fan, his newest book is, it's just so good. He does the same thing where he takes what's going on, like the latest technological innovations, what's going on in society, projects it forward like 40, 50 years. And he's like, taken to the extreme, what would this be? And you're like, wow, this is crazy. It's really good.
Have you read Neal Stephenson?
I have not.
Snow Crash is one of,
okay. I'm familiar. Yeah.
It's an older book at this point, but that guy is like, he's my modern day type source for that type of stuff. Now, I've actually even looked at getting him on the show, but like his whole website is basically never invite me to your show. That's what he said.
Yeah, a lot of those really talented writers are a bit reclusive. You know, they're not super social.
No, I get it. I'm not even mad. Whatever. But the dude is super talented. So if you are looking for something with a little bit more of a, I mean, I actually need to read the peripheral, what you said, but something that's kind of like a really intelligent, smartly done, very grounded, but still has that future slant to it. Stevenson is where it's at.
There's so many. I could talk about books for. That could be a 5-hour podcast if you were so inclined. But there's so much good stuff out there to read. I encourage people out there, if you're a fan of 40K, if you like sci-fi, fantasy, there's some incredibly talented people out there writing amazing stuff. And you should check it out.
Gibson is, I mean, he's architect. I mean, that's like so much stuff is based off of just his original writings. And I'm sure that plays a lot into 40K stuff.
Yeah, 100%, dude. It's... Well, I mean, he coined the frame cyberspace in that book, right? That's where that word comes from that we use in everyday vernacular now. So, yeah, it's awesome. And I'll throw one more out there, Greg Egan, his book Diaspora. If you want to read the most mind-bending science fiction book that's based in like real science, real mathematics, it's hard sci-fi. Check it out, and it will turn your brain inside out. It's amazing.
Dude, I love getting back into the roots of like fantasy and sci-fi novels and things like, you know, the guy who wrote Tarzan. Of course, no one realizes that's the guy who did like Gods of Mars, you know, John Carter of Mars and all that. Like, and that was kind of one of the first sci-fi books ever. You know, this idea that here's this guy who's writing a story who lived during the time where there were Civil War veterans, and he sends one to Mars. Like, what is that like?
It's a Southern gentleman that goes to Mars, dude. And he has like a flintlock. Well, not quite, but he has like a cavalry saber and almost a black powder pistol. And that's all he's got.
And we've been sending like robots to Mars, and we know a whole lot more about Mars now. But what did people know about Mars in like the 1890s?
And it's like, incredible.
Not much, like just the imagination that comes from that idea. I love getting back to those old things, like old fantasy. I've been on kind of a classic movie stint. My next one's Flash Gordon.
That's one of my favorite movies of all time.
Still, to this day, the silliest but most amazing, awesome
Come
movie.
On,
the
man.
Soundtrack.
There's so much.
I just love
so Brian much there. Blessed.
It's so good, dude. Like when they play football and like beat up the robots, it's just the best. When the Hawkmen come in and oh my gosh, it's so good, dude.
Yeah.
Have you seen it?
And
Chris?
On the fantasy side, Conan. You know, watching Conan.
One of the all-time greats.
Indeed. Well, yeah, we could actually probably do a whole other show on this stuff. I want to put in a plug. While I'm talking about it, Cryptonomicon is one of my all-time. It's by Neal Stephenson. Mm-hmm. It takes place in like modern. It's not super sci-fi, but it's one of my favorite books of all time. Everyone should read it. We should actually do a show just on the must-read books for things to contribute to our nerdness.
Oh, dude, I could go on and on and on. Like, especially if you do master, like if you expand it beyond books, like graphic novels and like movies too. It's just like there's a wealth of just people that are like genius level like you that are making just amazing art out there. It's worth exploring.
Yeah, so I can't wait to get Mr. Anandell on to talk about the Warhammer horror stuff. But like, it's neat that this is all still all relevant to everything we've been talking about.
Indeed, yeah, this is where 40K has its roots in all of these things. Like all the time, people are like, oh man, this is such a cool universe. And I'm like, dude, they pilfered all the best ideas from all the best sci-fi and fantasy of the time, and then they turned it into something unique. And
what's the Inquisitor?
It's like, just go read Dune.
Rambo.
Yeah, Dune. Clouseau. Starship Troopers.
No, it's Obi-Wan Jean Clouseau.
That's right.
Yeah. No, Obi-Wan. It's like Obi-Wan Solo Clouseau or something like that. And like, it's literally the names of like a famous detective, a Jedi, and like a like something else I can't remember.
But that's like canon. There's a picture of him in the old books,
right? He has a yin yang tank top, a duster, and like a cowboy hat. It's amazing.
Okay. Well,
it's
we
nice
left
to
off,
look back on the 80s.
Yeah, we left off the last segment where we're talking about mission changes to the ITC. Are those available for people to view right now?
Yeah, and shout out, credit where it's due. The chief librarian himself handles most of that because I have a tendency to screw up all the formatting on all the documentation.
I know, yeah. Reese has been in there because I get a message like a day later. Hey, the stuff's not on the right page.
Does it work? But
no,
yeah,
I'm happy to do it.
And thank you so much, dude. Like you're obviously very talented at it. But go check it out. Click on the ITC Champions missions. You can see the new stuff. And just remember, this is all beta for the month of March. So play them, practice them, think about them, talk about them with your friends and your clubmates and teammates. And then let us know what you think. We're going to cast a vote at the end of the month for things like deployment. Do you like them? Do you like the new missions? Do you not like them? Should we change them? And then we'll nail them down and set them in stone at the end of March for the rest of the season.
I do want to point out that these things are up for people who are going to view them even casually. So if you're looking to start something in your area, they are a good place to start to build your own missions or use them right off the website.
Yeah, indeed. It's not just like us telling everybody how to play again. This is the result of literally thousands of people and hundreds of TOs working together to build what we think is the best out-of-the-box way to run match play events.
That's the best thing. I mean, just back in the early days of FTN or whatever, when it was the end of fifth, the beginning of sixth, and that kind of stuff. I mean, taking feedback from people about what's going to make the events and missions enjoyable, and then incorporating that into something digestible. That's what you guys have done with the missions, and that's it's good. It's even if you don't use them and you want to do your own thing, you still have your own ideas of what's going to work in your area. I think it is a good place to start, at least.
Yeah, I agree all the time. I agree 100%. And like all the time, people like email me in and they're like, oh, hey, we made this change to the ITC missions in our local community. Everybody loves it. Hey, you know, here's some good feedback. You might want to like it. Like, we had a local group, I think, or not a local group. We had a group local to you that they, one of the secondaries is always old school, right? And they're like, oh, everybody loves it because everybody knows how to do it. And, just little tweaks like that are like, oh, okay. Everybody here hates using Vanguard Strike. So, we just say like, you always reroll it if you get that one. And it's like, that's totally cool, right? If that's, if you want to tweak it or just replace it, or mix it, go 50% ITC, 50% whatever, book missions or whatever you want to do, you're 100% free to do that.
You still get to contribute points. You still get to whatever, get your event registered and have people in your event or in your area scoring points in the ITC and get to see their name up in lights against some of the best in the world.
Exactly.
Yes. I mean, good times, man. I really like where things are going and I'm going to be also competing a lot more this year. But that's part of the club thing. See, I've got a club and we want to compete. So they're like, hey, get out there, Murphy.
Yeah, it was funny. The Finest Hour podcast just had a cast about the importance of joining a club. Like, if you want to take your hobby to the next level, even if you don't give a rat's behind about competition or winning or losing the game, you're gonna get so much more enjoyment and longevity out of your hobby if you join a club. It's seriously it's the best thing you can do to make your hobby better for you. And if you are competitive, literally every single person in the top, like 10, 15, probably even more than that. I know the top 150, it's like 99.9% of them are in a club. So if you want to get better at the game, that is the easiest thing you can do to get better at the game.
And clubs get accessories. We got hoodies. We got shirts. We got koozies.
It's fun, man. The game's inherently social, right? Like, if you wanted to play a video game and like scream obscenities at 13-year-olds playing Call of Duty, you could do that by yourself in your bedroom. But if you want to go out and have friends and have real human interactions, that's why we play tabletop games.
Yeah, I'm actually super excited. I'm also in the same club as Paul now. He had pity on me, or whatever it is that he, however you want to say it. But the idea was that I wanted to be able to surround myself and interact with people who held the same kind of hobby goals that I did. That is, you know, strong paint, good play, you know, tactical play, and people that, you know, if I put up a list in a group, people that will be like, okay, well, this part sucks, get rid of that, or say this is good, or hey, I'm trying a new faction out. What do you think? What should I buy? What should I do? Like, I wanted to surround myself with people who I knew that I could count on to be honest, but also to be fun. And to have that kind of atmosphere. And it's been really fun so far. I think I've only been on the team for what, like a week, week and a half?
Feels like forever.
Yeah, poor Paul. Poor Paul. It's like, hey, you need to get rid of those tactical marines. Like, well, I don't have anything else.
Pretty much put up a no tactical marine. I
don't have anything else. By the way, they only died in one of my five games this last weekend, Paul. I just want to throw that out there.
Chris, I'm going to throw you some love from a fellow Space Marine enthusiast. Just give them a sergeant with a signum, an extra heavy weapon, use them as devastators, which they're infinitely better at, and you're going to be a lot happier and they do the same thing.
I've got the devastators too, but I don't think Paul would make fun of me.
See what we're working with here. See what we're working with.
I still use devastator. I use three units of devastators in every single game I play in my Space Marines. I've only lost two games with my new list, and the Devastators just do work. They're really good.
I would like to go on record as saying I do not support anything you guys are talking about right now.
But hey, he's got Gilliman, so there's.
I do have RPG.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, there's some value to that when you can pretty much just count on rerolling everything. As for me, my favorite thing was actually the Leviathan. I took a Leviathan Dreadnought because I've been getting it ready for my 30K stuff coming up for Adepticon.
It's such a beast. It can be such a spoiler unit sometimes.
That thing soaked up so much damage. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. It was a big bully. Even if it didn't kill a lot of things, the amount of time and energy that my opponent spent on taking it down just out of the fear of it made it so that the rest of the stuff in my army was actually able to win me the game, like win me the objectives while they were trying to deal with the Leviathan and the threat it presented. So I was super happy with it. I named it the Kingslayer, and in my first game, I was super I was super happy because I actually killed Ragnar with it, you know, the young king. So I was like, it's destiny. Yeah.
Is it, so it's Jaime Lannister?
we'll say yes. but I have this sawed up king statue, I think from the Lord of the Rings raid range. That's on the bottom, so it looks like he's stepping over this busted statue of a king, an ancient king or whatever, and that's kind of like what I wanted to visualize him as, and so it was very satisfying to be able to do that with him in the first game. My most Pyrrhic moment, though, Pyrrhic victory moment, was the game I got crushed by some Cadians.
But before we get too far, this is in the charity tournament. This is where so if you wouldn't mind recapping just what the event was about and then going ahead.
Absolutely. And we've talked about it on the show before, but we set up this event with Warhammer hero Mario Capizzo, who he won the Warhammer Hero Award because of the first one that we did back in 2017. And we raised, I think it was about $5,000 for charity that first year. And we wanted to be able to pull it off again, expand it, make it bigger. It was a GT the last time, and it was a GT again this time. I think, Reese, you talked about it on Chapter Tactics, but Ben Cromwell from your team came and he took the cake for the 40K GT. But what we did was, you know, the entry fee to the event was donating to the charity and showing your receipt. And then we had random prize drawings that were box sets, commissioned paint jobs from, because we have some very, very good hobbyists. You know, Lou Rollins, who you mentioned earlier in the show, Reese, he's a local guy. And he auctioned off several of his own models, several of the ones that were part of that win that he got, that big display. He sold off some of those for the charity. So, you know, he definitely a committed human being, such a good guy. I was so happy for him when he won, a solid human being, and so great that he would, you know, take something that would obviously have some significance to him and say, all right, I'm going to get rid of this and raise money for charity. You know, myself, I was very happy to have five people sponsoring me Battle Point for Battle Point to raise money for Fisher House and Children's Miracle Network. So I played all five rounds, and even though, you know, you go into it and you go into it with like a pure faction Blood Angels, people are like, oh, so maybe you'll go like 1-4 or 2-3. And you know, people automatically kind of dismiss you to start off with. Oh, I had a good time. And I ended up going 3-2.
Good for you.
So it's nice. There's something very satisfying about playing an underdog and doing better than people expect, even if you don't take the cake. You could say I'm used to that from years of being a Blood Angel player, but we won't go into that right now. but my first game, of course, was a Space Wolf Knight Guard combo list. Your typical kind of suit.
That old combo.
That was a really fun game, huh?
That old combo that you read about in all the books.
Yep, that's right. And my second game, this was probably my most fun game. It was my first loss. It was a very close game. I lost because I clocked out. But it was 240 gaunts, and there were so many bugs.
Wait, and you clocked out?
Yeah, and this is why. This is the hilarious part, because I basically gave him the first lesson of the Blood Angel School of holding fortifications. Do you know what that lesson is, Reese?
Mm-mm.
Charge out of the fortification. So I abandoned my defensive positions and just charged into his big piles of bodies. And I was rolling a ton of attacks, and I tied up most of his units in combat. So he had all these bodies who didn't have a lot of attack dice, who also couldn't shoot. So I spent all of my time rolling and killing his models and ended up clocking out because he didn't have time to roll any of his shooting dice that normally would take forever to do that. It was a really fun game.
Dice zap, my friend.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when you've got a bunch of tiny units and things, like I could have done a lot more to kind of speed things up, for sure. It's always a lesson when you're playing on the clock, like in terms of clock discipline. It was a really fun game. Ended up losing it, but still scored 20 points. You know, and I was fighting for every point I could get. Really, he came to LVO too. You may have even seen his army. His name's Rich, but he's really solid guy. Loved playing him. Loved that game. My third game, it was, oh gosh, this was my buddy Micah. You remember Micah?
Mika.
He's great.
Yeah, you remember Mika. also running Tyranny. So it was definitely a devastation of ball kind of day for me on day one.
Yeah, that is a tough road to hoe.
He played him. I can tell you, I'm really tired of Hive Guard. I'm so very tired of Hive Guard.
They're so good, dude.
So good.
Give Tyranids their one little, give them their unit, their all-star, you know, let them have it.
No, I let them have it. I'm just so tired of being shot by them. Micah and I have this, for the last four or five events that we both have played in, we always end up being matched up against each other. So it's kind of become this grudge match. Who's going to get it this time, right? And there's always a bunch of Hive Guard. But I ended up tabling him, I think, on turn four with my Leviathan / Derridaeo combo. He had a big one of those huge gargantuan creature bugs. That cat has the flamer cannon on its back. I forget what it's called. Like a barbed Hyrodule or something like that.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, it's a Hyrodule. Not the barbed Hyrodule. Yeah, it is. It's the barbed Hyrodule.
Barbed or scythe. One of the Hyroduels. And he used the Swarmlord to just rush that up in my face. And thanks to some lucky saves on the Leviathan, I managed to live long enough to crush it in return with my Smash Captain and the Leviathan and the Sanguinor. And, you know, because it's not a Blood Angel list unless half your army is characters. But it was a really fun game. Ended up tabling him, got a really good win. And then the next game was against the Cadians. And that was one where I was just like, whew. All right, this is going to hurt, and it sure did. But that was also my most Pyrrhic victory game because he was using the model for the Lord Solar Macarius as his warlord.
He's my main HQ in my Tempestus Scions list.
Yeah. Oh, just because of his armor or whatever?
And his dope staff.
He used to be such a hoss, too. He'd let you go first automatically.
Yeah. That's pretty good.
That was his ability.
Paul.
You go first.
That's a pretty good ability.
Yeah, it was strong. It was real strong.
You don't see him mentioned much aside from, you know, Black Library books nowadays. People may not know that he was also named the War Master, right? Like the only person to be named War Master since
he was Horus. The only human. Well, yep. Abaddon titled himself the War Master, but he didn't get the actual title.
Yeah, he didn't get it from the Emperor, so it doesn't count. I actually killed. I was using my Sanguinius model as the Sanguinor in this, with, you know, of course, the proper approval, and I was able to kill the War Master with Sanguinius in that game, and that felt really good.
If just only Horus had Toughness 3, you know?
Yeah. It would have been a lot easier.
It would have been a lot easier if he was Toughness 3, that's right. It was a fun game, and he played it really well. I made a couple of mistakes, I think, that may not have... If I hadn't done them, I may not have won the game anyway, but I think it would have been better. I kind of ran right into his Augrin with my Sanguinary Guard. And it would have been smarter to avoid them, I think, and present several targets for his artillery to shoot at instead of just slugging it out with my toughest unit against, you know, Augrin aren't going to move around anywhere really fast, and they will deal some damage.
You're talking about Bulgrin or Ogryn?
Yeah, Bulgrin. Sorry. Yeah.
I was like, if he's using Ogryn, tell me more about this because I love Ogryn.
But do you really Bulgrin have are amazing between Bulgrin and Ogryn in your mind?
Dude, one of them wears a tank top with an automatic shotgun. The other one has armor with a power baseball bat and a giant
one
piece
of them,
metal.
One of them, like their battle cry is diabetes. Yeah. Yeah. But I think if I had instead used the Sanguinary Guard to go alongside the Leviathan and put some pressure on his artillery line instead of having the Leviathan over there by himself, that I would have had some better success. Maybe I wouldn't have pulled out the win, but I was able to, you know, score points. I played the whole game out again, trying to raise money, right? So every point, if I give up, that's less points for the charity. So lost that game. And then I ended up playing Lou for round five. He had his Death Watch force there, of course. We had a nice slug out match. I ended up pulling out the win for. So it was a really fun weekend.
That's cool, man. We did great for a great cause, and glad to hear about it.
Yeah, it sounds like a blast.
We're raising more money this month with other events too. If I wasn't going to Adepticon, there's another tournament going on for 40K at the end of the month. But anybody who still feels like, hey, I'd like to donate to that, we're still collecting money. So hit me up on Facebook, send a message to the page, and I can let you know what you can do to contribute. All the money goes right to the charity. No one's keeping any of it. So.
Yeah, that's great.
Well, where's the fun in that?
God, we are running out of. I need to talk about Gene Stealer cults, but we keep running out of time and whatever. But this is a dynamic codex. I mean, this is, I don't know if, I mean, we've actually stalled until the FAQ has come out.
We haven't done a review on our cast yet either. It's just, it's like, yeah, like you said, it's dynamic. That's a nice way.
It just kind of snuck up and came out right when we were busy doing something else.
Right?
And it was like there's a lot of unique things in here that are going to, I mean, it's going to affect the game. And so if you've got someone that gets really good at this in your area, then, I mean, it's you're of course going to see it all the time. But I think it has a bit of a learning curve to it.
Oh, it's a high skill, like it's like Yanari, but even more so. Like if you're really good at it, you're going to smash people. If you're not, you're going to get smashed. I think it's the highest degree. It'll multiply your skill level to the highest degree of any codex we've seen.
Yeah,
because of the shrouded deployment and because of the stratagems. I mean, what is causing you to say that?
There's so many tricks in this deck that if you're a casual gamer, you're going to miss 90% of what the army can do. But if you're a dedicated, focus gamer, you're going to be able to pull, like, it doesn't matter what scenario you find yourself in, you're going to be able to pull some rabbit out of your hat and do something that's either unexpected or, less expected, right? Unless you're going against somebody that's equally skilled as you, you're going to be able to pull some weird trick on somebody that's going to take away their momentum or take away one of their key units.
That's what I was hoping you'd get, yeah. Because, I mean, there are everywhere you turn, there could be assassins around here. You're able to appear right next to someone with a ton of quality firepower. I mean, the quantity of firepower that becomes its own quality.
I hate those demolition charges.
The hand flamers.
Oh my gosh.
Go ahead, Chris. I'm sorry.
No, I was just kind of to mirror what Paul was saying. Is like there's always something, right? And their ability to get in close. Like the only other thing in the game really that can get in close, like closer than the 9 inches, is like the Calidus assassin, right? And that's if you roll right. You could start, set up next to somebody. These will let you start close to something and then move in. And one of the guys who play, I think he went 4-1 this last weekend with the new Genes to their Cult Codex. He is really good at positioning himself so that, oh, here's this character that I really need to get rid of. I'm going to drop a bunch of demolition charges on him. This is how I need to move, and this is how I need to be so that he's the closest target. Like, you have to, as a defensive player, be so ready for everything to go horribly wrong.
Yeah.
And as the Genes to their Cult player, to Paul's point, if you do not know what this does, you're just going to be shooting in the dark. I feel like the power of this book is so obvious, but the method of concentrating that into intelligent choices on the table is going to create this initial surge of Gene Stealer Cult players that are going to filter down to the people who are really dedicated, who can really kind of figure it out and get it.
Yeah, 100%. And then if you do it wrong, as a Gene Stealer Cult player, your army will fold because everything's squishy and all your little combos rely on lots of different little squishy characters to be done correctly. So if you misplay it, if you misjudge it, or you just make a mistake, all of a sudden your army just cascades downwards. We was at a GT this past weekend. We had a Gene Stealer Cult player go 4-1, and we had one that went 0-5. Like, I think that's going to be really reflective of how the codex plays out, right? Especially when the common combos become kind of go into the group consciousness of, oh, okay, when you're playing Gene Stealer Cult, expect the demo charge, bikes or the rock grinder with the flamers or whatever. When people get used to it and know how to counter it, the really canny player is going to have to find those little chinks in the armor. And I think a lot of people will give up on it because they are, it's such a glass cannon.
Yeah, I think so. And the models are also beautiful. I mean, I want to talk about how the Locus model. Model's insane. It can be used for lots of different things. I've already seen a bunch of kit bashes to make this thing like a necromancer or whatever. Not to get too sidetracked off attack, but that goes into this thing has a ton of characters, and much like the Marine Codex and Casperine Brothers, they give lots of buffs out to lots of different units. And so if you can stack up those aura zone things, you got some really powerful things.
Yeah, totally. Right. Like that's a perfect analog. Whereas a Space Marine right now is really lackluster when he shouldn't be, but he is. When you layer on all the different crazy buffs, he turns into a super soldier, and the Gene Stealer Cults are the exact same way.
Except Gene Stealer Cults have like +1 attack above. So they fall like 4, 3, 4, and 5 attacks.
Yeah, like some of it I think is a bit much, quite frankly. But again, the saving grace is that they're so fragile And if you're really good at like screening out, estimating what the threat ranges of your opponent's units are, understanding what their codex does, it's not quite so like gut punch as it is if you come into it cold and you're like, oh, geez, so cold. This is nice. Oh my God, what's happening? You know, like.
Well, there's a few different things that can throw you off your game with the blip deployment.
The blip deployment is one of the best things that they have.
Yeah, I agree with that. But it's also one of those things to where it's really not, I don't think, as intimidating as it appears the first time that you encounter it.
It's pretty intuitive, right? Like, you have to be a pretty canny player to not do the obvious thing with blip deployment. Like, you know what I mean? Like, if they put the blips in certain places, you're like, I have a relatively high odds of guessing what's going to be where.
So what it is, the first round, you don't have to deploy your actual troops. You can deploy what are tokens on the and the codex comes with some cardboard tokens. Of course, you can use whatever you want, but you deploy the tokens instead of your unit, and you reveal them the first turn. If you go second, they're revealed, I think, right before the game starts. Is that right?
Yeah, it's like after the roll to go first, before, after the Cs or something like that.
Yep.
If I remember correctly, yeah, it's something like that.
So, I mean, they're on the table after the game starts, but still when you're lining up with your deployment as an opponent, you're still not looking at any models. You're looking at tokens, which could be technically anything, but what you're saying is you have to be really, really savvy and figure out some kind of deep strategy to not be overly apparent with what the tokens represent.
Yeah, but the savvy Gene Stealer Cole player is going to go second, like, almost every time.
Because they have more drops.
Well, if you go second, you reveal your blips after your opponent starts doing everything, and then their blips get revealed. So it's an army that wants to go second more often than not. It depends on your missions. It may not always be the case. But, like, you can't come within 9 inches of a blip, if I remember correctly.
Yep. You can't deploy within 9 inches of a blip or move within 9 inches of a blip or whatever. So, yep.
It's an army that wants to go second. It's a reactive army, right? You let your opponent waste a movement phase, unveil your stuff, counterpunch. And especially in missions like ITC missions or any missions like that, going second is better, generally speaking, anyway.
Yeah, I'm with you. And they have a completely new, unique psychic tree. Which does allow you to do things like take over a model and shoot. I mean, that was same from the index and the
course. Yeah, it's a was it mind control?
Mind control.
And then the one that's absolutely bonkers and needs to be FAQ'd immediately, and GW Phantom FAQ'd it, was Mental Onslaught, the infinite loop.
Infinite mortal wounds.
It was funny because the first FAQ was like, oh, there's a limit on it. And then it got changed midday, and they're like, oh, there's no limit. And you're like, why? Like, what? What?
Working as intended, man.
Well... yeah, that combo is not that difficult to pull off, but it can literally kill a warlord or an imperator titan in one shot.
Oh man!
But that kind of does.
Operating,
I mean,
as intended.
I mean, it does kind of funnel into the glass cannon. These things. I mean, you have to be fairly close to your opponent.
It's not hard to pull off, Paul. Don't defend it.
Oh no! I'm not saying it's hard, but you have to be. You have to be exposed.
Not really. It's 18 inch range, and you can appear almost anywhere on the table.
Yeah, but then you're there. I mean, I guess, okay, I don't mean to be defending an infinite mortal wound mechanism.
Yeah, you just want to try it. We know.
But I may or may not have this model painted. No, but don't. No, what I'm saying is that the thing about the Gene Stealer cults in general is that you are putting a bunch of bodies really close to someone else's army, and that doesn't always work out for you.
Yeah, and the other parts of it too is like a lot of armies like Space Marines or Eldar have the ability to shoot units when they appear on the table. That's really good. And then again, screening units is critical against Gene Stealer cult. If your screening game is good, you're going to dramatically mitigate what they can do to you.
Yeah, we talk about this on other shows, but you can't lazily deploy your stuff.
Oh.
And when you're fighting some of these things but you can't do it against orcs, you can't do it against Tyranids.
Or Blood Angels, for that matter. Like, anything that can sucker punch you, you have to be aware of it. And the advice I always give people is just ask. Just 99% of the people that play the game are really congenial, and they're friendly, and they're nice. And they don't, like, the bad part of them, that's like 10% of them, they want to get a gotcha moment. But most of them feel bad when they do it. Just ask them before you start playing the game, like, hey, what's your army's trick?
Do you have a 6-inch consolidate?
Yeah. What's the thing that you do? And especially before the game begins, the vast majority of people would be like, oh, hey, you know, my Gene Steel coat army can appear 3 inches in front of you, you know, on the first turn. You're like, oh, well, geez, that's pretty rough, you know. all you have to do is ask. And most of the time people will let you know, and then you can counter for it and you have a much more enjoyable game.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. But there are we should devote an episode to this, to talking about some of the army list and the combos and whatnot. But this army has a bunch of things that I think that are just the intent. The army is supposed to be subtle, and so it may seem like some gotcha stuff. But if you just kind of learn to anticipate a little bit, it's not so bad. But then you've got to play the deep game with the Gene Steel cults and anticipate the other people's anticipation.
Yeah, that's true. It's definitely a game of shells.
Which takes you back to 47 hand flamers.
Yeah, yeah. I got that last week. I got the 20 hand flamers in the face. It's pretty brutal, but like, it's a one shot pony. Like,
but it can do a lot of damage.
They pop
to things.
Up. Yeah. Oh, I'm not trying to say it's not good or anything, but like, that unit pops up, it does this thing, and then it dies. And again, that's why your screen game has to be on point.
Yeah, but I think that's true with a lot of the stuff in the Gene Steel in the cults section here. But they've also got those assassins and stuff. So I mean, I know assassins are gonna make a huge comeback, like for the Imperial side. But the snipers and things on the cult side, I mean, you have the ability to put a lot of those things on the table and take out people's buff units. These things with the auras and whatever.
Yeah, the Keller Morph is so good.
What's that guy doing? What are you saying he's good for?
The gunslinger that pops up and just blasts you off the table. He's so good.
So the model can target enemy characters even if they are not the closest enemy unit. In addition, each time this model hits an enemy with a pistol weapon, it can immediately make one additional hit roll against the target using the same weapon.
Paul, I'm not a mathematician, but that sounds pretty good to me.
It is. Well, he has pistol 2, neg 1 AP, damage 2 weapons. That's his basic weapon.
Yeah, he is.
He has three of those.
Solid.
And for what? Three. Yeah. If you haven't looked at the model, this is the guy with all the arms. He's the gunslinger guy. He has three of those pistols that shoot two each with two damage. And those hits don't generate extra ones, but he's still shooting a lot with two damage weapons.
He looks like Clint Eastwood from The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly as an alien with three arms.
Yeah. That's the one you can get out of the Kill Team box set right now, I think, currently, or the character pack.
I believe so, yeah.
That's the one they previewed a long time ago. It's a spectacular model.
Yeah, and it's incredibly good on the tabletop, too, for like such a bargain price.
It's a 12-inch range. What's the Keller Morph looking like? 60 points, and then his Liberator auto stub pistols are 0 points. So he's 60 points total.
That's character pretty killer. Good. That's pretty good.
He's BS2+, so you're not wrong there.
Yeah, he's amazing. But that codex is chock full of stuff like that. You know, it's a great book. Possibly a little too strong, but it has so many good tricks up its sleeve. And again, watching it played, it folds quickly when the wheels come off the bus. It's like a cascading negative effect, very similar to orcs. Orcs, in my experience, when they start to lose, they lose. It's just like a landslide.
That's my opinion too. Is like this. And I know you mentioned glass cannon, to where I completely agree with that. If you're able to take their power pieces off the table, then but that comes with target priority and threat assessment. You've got to know what you're dealing with.
Like, if you can take out the Patriarch, do it. It takes away a lot of the morale buffs, and then after that, it's relatively easy to pick them apart. You know, it's just little things like that to come with experience.
We'll delve more into that. I know I've been saying that for like a couple of weeks now that we're going to delve into it, but we really will. But this is something that takes, I think, a little, it needs a focus on it to really help with this threat assessment. But Reese and Chris, I really appreciate y'all coming on tonight.
Thanks for having us.
It's a good time.
Anything else y'all want to chat about before we wrap this up?
Well, I just want to point out, Reese, you need to get some more assassins in stock, because I just tried to get some and they're gone.
Nobody can get them right now, dude. Like,
I'm holding you personally responsible.
It's so funny too, because like, I have conversations with people at G-Dubs, and then they're like, oh, you know, the rules, it seems to be like, you know, across, people just buy models because they like them. And I'm like, well, as a store owner, I can tell you, if something has good rules, I can't get it. So maybe my experience is unique. However, it does appear that rules do sell models.
What's that Custode's big giant flyer?
Orion gunship?
Yeah.
Sold out after the point change.
Yeah, well, just today, the Telamon and the different Contemptor dreadnoughts just went back up for sale after being sold out. That was not that long after the Custodes rules dropped for the beta rules for 40K.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's great for me.
It's interesting, too. I'm like, I just so badly I want to just like see the data. I'm like, tell me more, because having been in the game for like almost 8 years now, that does not reflect the reality that I have experienced. But, you know, obviously on a much smaller scale.
I can promise you if ball predators got better, there would be a complete rush on them.
Yeah, it happens every single time. The rules
I'd
change.
I'd love to see that, by the way.
It was like when the Orc Codex came out, mech guns, when everybody thought they were going to be the most overpowered thing in the game in the world, could not find them for weeks. Like, it happens over and over and over.
Yeah, absolutely, man. God, well, thank you all for talking about this. We will expand more on Army List. We're going to talk it next week. We'll talk about more tournaments that are coming up. Of course, we're getting ready for Adepticon. Right after that is the Barnyard Brawl, which we'll be playing in. And if that's right near me, it's like a couple hours away. It's in South Carolina. I can't wait to roll some dice in that and Adepticon. I've been painting stuff on Twitter. You can see it up on Twitter. I've painted almost 3,000 points of Imperium in the last 2 months.
Wow.
It's been insane. Yeah. But, you know, it's what you got to do for the team tournament.
That is one of the big requirements of the team tournament. It's a huge hobby commitment.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pageant in the best way possible to describe, I think. But it's one of the crown jewels of the hobby as far as the tournaments go, if you ask me.
Some of the passion displayed at that hobby passion is remarkable.
So on a great team, I mean, they've been funneling miniatures my way, make sure I had everything I needed to get it done in time. Going to be sending it off, going to be mailing it to one of the other teammates so they can get some more practice games in. And then it's all going to magically show up in Chicago.
Awesome. Good luck, dude.
Yeah, appreciate it, man. I'll keep trying to get these
Assault Marines finished. I know you guys love that.
I'm going to pretend you didn't say that.
I'm actually not going to
make it. It's 30K, so calm down, Paul.
Okay, cool.
I'm actually not going to make it this year because I didn't buy my tickets soon enough, and every event is selling out in like record time now. So I'm kicking myself, and I didn't get tickets to either the 40K or AOS Championships, which I was hoping to play in both. So everybody else, I hope you have fun, because I'm number like 110 on the wait list.
you might make it. You never know. You know how the churn is, especially
when
you're closer to the event.
I know. Like, yeah, I was just like, God, is that? I don't know if that's worth making the trip or not. But
oh man, well, yeah.
I'm going to stay home.
Yeah, thank you all for coming on and chatting tonight. Especially, you know, looking forward to seeing how the ITC continues to evolve. Now, of course, want to congratulate you personally on the success of the LVO and everything that you guys are building over there at FLG.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
We'll talk again soon.
Happy to be a part of helping you with that, man.
And thank you, dude. You guys run the 40K event. Like I said, I'm just the guy in the back, like shaking hands now. So thank you to you guys, Chris, for facilitating it.
It's a great experience. You guys have a good night.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Thanks for listening.